As we have observed in the past, we're not great in our culture about talking about death. It's not a subject most people like to talk about. Our guest this hour reminds us that part of the reason is that we just do not know death like our great-grandparents and earlier generations knew it. Disease and death were constant companions in the days before vaccines and antibiotics and modern surgery, so we live longer and generally better, but we can't escape death. So, Katie Butler urges us to think about it and plan for it. Her latest book is The Art of Dying Well, a practical guide to a good end of life. Katie Butler has explored this before. Her previous book, Knocking on Heaven's Door, covered how medical technology can keep our bodies alive, often past our wishes. Katie also writes articles for the likes of the New York Times Magazine and Scientific American. Katie Butler, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much, Jeff. I'm really happy to be here.
Your first paragraphs bring up a real, oh yeah, moment. We don't know death because medical science is much more advanced than in our ancestors' days.
Exactly. And that has created a prolonged gray zone between active living and active dying. There's been extraordinary benefits, obviously, to modern medicine, but the result is that the very end of life, we have moved it out of the home where it was regarded as a spiritual ordeal rather than a medical procedure. We've delegated it to medicine. We've moved it into hospitals and nursing homes. And as a result, I think we've become actually more afraid of it than our ancestors were.
Well, and it makes sense because if going to the hospital late in life is a place from which you might not return, this is not it has kind of a boogeyman quality to it in this way.
It does, and especially because I think innately we have a sense that we want some meaning and some ceremony and some humanity and some human connection as we actually die. And we often become intimidated in these hospital environments. They are very good at prolonging life, but they're not good at preparing us for peaceful deaths or supporting us if we're having a death in the hospital. So in my book, I really encourage people to speak up, rise to the occasion, take the power, because you can actually humanize a hospital death to a great extent if you have the guts to ask for what you need, frankly.
Okay, we'll get into the things you need to ask for and of whom to ask them, but I do want to go back in time a bit to follow the beginning of the book where you give us a hint of what bedside rituals were like for dying people centuries ago. They were quite prescribed, it sounds like, with lots of roles for lots of people.
I think it was just tremendous. They were really the first self-help books, and they were bestsellers. I'm talking about 1450 onward for the next couple hundred years. The leading one was called Ars Moriendi, or The Art of Dying, and it was actually illustrated with woodcuts so that people who were not literate could also understand what it was about. And they describe five, what they call them temptations to sin, but they're just natural human emotions that occur around the deathbed, such as remorse, fear of the afterlife, not wanting to be in pain, feeling great sorrow for giving up the things and the beloved peoples of the world. And they actually prescribed essentially like scripts for your attendants, for the people who were taking care of you. So if you expressed remorse, they would reassure you that God was merciful and say, well, if there was any chance you could recover, you'd want to make that right, wouldn't you? And the dying person would say, well, of course I would. And then they say, well, don't worry about it then. God's merciful. It's going to be okay, in essence. So they had, I think death in those days was often quite painful because they didn't have the pain control levels that we have now, especially to hospice. But they really understood the emotional and spiritual ordeals of the deathbed. And dying is a relational process. We need each other to get through it well. And they really made it as easy as possible for people in those days.
Well, a rite of passage at which the family was present, as they're present
exactly.
For births and they're present for marriages, or weddings, rather.
Exactly. And I part of the point of my book is to help people improvise a sense of the sacred and a sense of ritual into these major changes that we all go through and have such meaning for us.
Katie, are you encouraged by more people speaking about it, writing about it, the presence of death cafes and things like that?
Absolutely. But I think there's a trend, which is to say, go to a death cafe or go to a death over dinner and sign your advance directives, and then everything's going to be fine. And there's a big gap between setting your intentions and talking about it and actually weaving through this long labyrinth, highly medicalized, that takes us from active living to active dying.
So I'm getting the sense from what you're saying that people are like, okay, I filled the forms out. Let's get this past us and move on.
Well, yeah. And then we're confronting a medical system that tends to be very fragmented, doesn't like to talk about death or decline at all, where doctors are very poorly educated to have these conversations. And so, and modern medicine is a subculture of its own, and we often feel disempowered in relation to it and have difficulty speaking up about our deepest desires. So these difficult, nitty-gritty conversations about things like, what does quality of life mean to me? And if I can't live that quality of life, what are the medical procedures I just as soon say no to? I'll give you a simple example, dialysis. Dialysis is a tremendous thing, especially for people who have resilience and are not approaching the end of their lives. But it's now becoming a routine for people within their last year of life, in their very late life, as though you ought to go on dialysis, you must go on dialysis, it's time to go on dialysis, instead of allowing people to say no and normalize a no if they really feel they've lived good lives and they don't want to go through that level of extreme difficulty.
In fact, I have a friend who told me his kidneys were failing and he was opting not to do dialysis because he lived a good life and that was it. So
exactly.
He shuffled off a couple of years ago. The book is called The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. Katie Butler is the author and our guest, and I see you're going to be at Powell's Books in Portland on Sunday.
That's right. I'm looking forward to it. So I hope I see you there.
Bit of a drive for us, but if anybody from Eugene on Northward would think about it, there we go. Katie Butler and The Art of Dying Well, back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about the end today, the end of life. Katie Butler followed up the bestseller Knocking on Heaven's Door with a book called The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. This is more than forms. It's about checking out how your body's doing, how your mind is doing, and sort of going with the flow as you begin to look toward a part of life when you're not here anymore. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Many questions, no doubt, some experiences to share. Please join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Katie, the book is organized in a progression. Tell us about how you arranged it.
Yes, it's really a book about living well in your last third of life, because living well segues really naturally into dying well. So I name what I call a gray zone between active living and active dying. So starting when you're getting those first glimmers that you're aging, you know, your hips don't feel so great, whatever it is that comes up first. I call that stage resilience, because that's a stage where you could still reverse problems by more exercise, diet changes, exactly. So the book progresses through resilience, slowing down, coping with and adapting to some degree of disability, which we probably, most of us, are going to do. I have a chapter called Awareness of Mortality, about how to cope with a frightening, life-threatening diagnosis, make a good plan, and then moving on to House of Cards, when we actually become fragile and we're better off if we stay out of the hospital whenever possible because we can't take the stress of it. And then finally preparing for a good death, and then the process of active dying itself. So at each of these stages, we require a little bit of a pivot in our expectations of medicine, in our sense of what medical allies can really help us in this situation, and also what forms of medicine that we might consider staying away from.
I like the fact that you refer to the portion of the book about resilience as you call this young old age,
yes,
for some people. But this is when I'm impressed by the level of detail here that this is a period when your body's healing system can still do you some good.
Exactly. That was one of the things I learned, much to my surprise. You can be over 65 and still see really, really significant changes if you start to exercise vigorously half an hour a day, for example, or improve your diet just a little bit. It's like never too late, especially with exercise. That can improve your quality of life until very close to the end. And I was floored by some of the stories I came across of people who had been told they should get on blood pressure meds and blood sugar meds and statins. And by making lifestyle changes, they were actually able to stay off all those drugs.
Just by getting a little more active, by getting into motion if they hadn't been?
Exactly. And that often requires group support of some kind. The Y, for example, holds pre-diabetes classes that have a really, really good track record at helping people make these changes.
One of the things that stands out from even I guess, is the introduction section of the book, the idea that people who die well tend to think of doctors as consultants, not bosses.
And yes.
So that's great if you're doing that as a patient, but what did you find in terms of physicians willing to take on that role?
Some of them are very eager to do that. Some of them are terrific. There's a real reform movement within medicine, almost like a counterculture within medicine, that's trying to improve how medicine takes care of people who are in this sort of realm of the unfixable stage of life. In the book, I have a story of a woman named Amy Berman. The first cancer doctor she went to just said to her, "Here's what we're going to do," and laid out a pathway of chemo, radiation, mastectomy, and then more chemo. And she already was stage 4, so she knew she wasn't going to survive. She wanted to maintain a high quality of life for as long as possible rather than, you know, try to root out a cancer that could not be rooted out. So she went to another oncologist, and the oncologist's first question was, "What are you hoping to accomplish?" So there are doctors who really welcome this collaborative attitude. But you're going to have to seek them out. And if you have a doctor who won't talk to you in plain English or won't tell you where things are heading, then I really recommend you fire that doctor and find someone who's more copacetic for you.
And there are some more practical reasons you give for thinking about switching doctors, particularly people whose doctors are older and not terribly close by to the neighborhood.
Right. As you get older, even just getting through the day becomes a problem at some point. You don't want to have to drive 20 miles for your doctor or your hairdresser or your car mechanic. So I recommend you get all of those local. But you also want to find a doctor who's younger than you, because this is the problem. Some very good doctors won't take new Medicare patients. When you're old, you become a very expensive patient to a doctor's practice because you've got numerous small problems, lots of gentle tinkering is required, many appointments, long appointments. You just don't pay for the amount that Medicare will reimburse at. So, but if you are already a patient of a good doctor and you age within his practice, he'll keep you on. So that's why I recommend getting a younger doctor who's not going to retire when you are, let's say, in your 70s, 80s, or 90s.
Katie Butler is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her latest book is The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. You provide some particular cautions in here, Katie, about being early adopters for new medical procedures.
Yeah.
Why?
Some of the biggest scandals in medicine involve medical devices that were grandfathered in. You can get a new device through a very streamlined approval process at the FDA if you just say, well, this is actually pretty similar to another device that's already been improved. So a terrible example was metal-on-metal hip implants. They turned out to shed shavings into the muscle. And they've been absolutely disastrous. So just like you're not supposed to buy a new car that's the first model of a new redo of a car, you want to wait for the beta testing and they fix the bugs by the next year. I don't recommend it. It's often sold to us as, oh, we have this innovative new surgery or this innovative new way of dealing with something, but often those innovations have not been vetted properly yet, and it's better to wait until they've been out in the general public for a while.
Above all, guard your brain, you say. And
yes.
In what senses?
Well, cognitive decline is one of the main reasons that people lose their independence. So again, if you've already had some cognitive decline, really think very carefully about something like an open heart surgery, because that can make your cognitive decline a lot worse,
So let me stop you there, because this is a really interesting point. So we're talking about taking care of our brains, but you're mentioning surgery here.
Yeah. There's something called post-operative cognitive decline, and it especially affects people after open heart surgery. You may lose very vital capacities by having been on a heart-lung machine for a couple of hours. So, and even merely the stress of being in a hospital, if you're old and fragile, can kick you into this thing called hospital delirium, which is a state of hallucinations and confusion. And again, people who suffer that are more likely to progress into dementia after they get out of the hospital. And then I also mentioned, we're really talking about the gloomy stuff here. The book has a lot of encouragement, too. I want to let you people know. It's really full of stories of people really doing great jobs in this stage of life. But another risk is anticholinergics. These are drugs. Some of them are over-the-counter drugs like Benadryl and antihistamines, anti-allergy pills. Anything that says on the label, beware of confusion or drowsiness or operating heavy machinery, you want to take a very careful look at that and minimize your use of those medications. Because, again, if you do years of heavy use of them, your risk of dementia is extremely, quite a bit greater.
Any research or thoughts on self-medication, you know, a couple of Manhattans or a joint after dinner?
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of moderation. There's obviously, there's nothing wrong with a drink or two or, you know, an occasional toke. That's not really a problem. But when you're doing heavy daily use, I really recommend, again, you can look in at Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. People quite late in life make these changes and are really glad they do, because they also find community there, not just stopping using a substance.
Katie Butler, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. We are talking about making plans and doing more than just filling out the forms, but actually spending some time thinking about this, planning it, deciding what looks like a good death to you. We have much more to talk about, and you can join the conversation on the Exchange with your thoughts, your experiences perhaps in this area with loved ones. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And speaking of loved ones, interactions with other people, even casual ones. How important is this to aging people?
It's extremely. I think it's important to all of us, but it becomes a life-saving necessity as you get older. Both are weak connections, like saying hi to the same barista every day at the Starbucks, and the deepening our connections with our neighbors, exchanging favors with our neighbors. This improves our health in so many different ways. Isolation and loneliness are health risks. If your neighbor knows you, they're more likely to look in on you if you don't pick up your paper in the morning. They're more likely to go pick something up for you at the pharmacy. And you can do the same for them. I think we really need to rebuild our social networks in community. They make a huge difference to our end of life. At the very end of life, it's really important to have at least one very dedicated friend who's willing to kind of take ownership if you're trying to die at home, and as many part-timers as you can muster. So joining a quilting group or a motorcycle club or the junior league, it really doesn't matter what group it is, but if you can find yourself your kinship group, your tribe, your posse, this can help a great deal as we approach the end of life.
Now, back to the medical end of things, and the reason that we have clear rules on our wishes late in life comes from a court case, the Cruzan decision. Can you explain that to us?
Yes. Nancy Cruzan was in a car accident by herself, and she was not breathing for well over 4 minutes. She was resuscitated, put eventually in a nursing home on a feeding tube. Her devout Catholic parents petitioned to be allowed to remove the feeding tube. And this went up to the Supreme Court, which ruled that we have the right to refuse any form of medical treatment, and a feeding tube counts as a form of medical treatment. The family eventually won the case, and they were allowed to remove the feeding tube. And so 7 years after she lost consciousness permanently, finally the feeding tube was taken out. That has led to the living will or the advanced directive, the appointing of someone to be your healthcare agent, because a crucial element of that case, and one of the reasons why her suspended animation was prolonged for so long, was that it wasn't clear what her wishes were prior to having this terrible accident. So now we record our wishes so it's crystal clear. There's no debate about it. If you don't want certain treatments, if you're in a certain state of mind or body, it should be down on paper so no one's confused, no one has to feel guilty afterwards, and you don't have to have a lot of conflict within the medical system to get your wishes honored.
The paperwork can get a little confusing, Katie. Is there a particular order or approach you advocate?
Yes, there's a wonderful document called Five Wishes. And you can get it for $5. And if you just Google Five Wishes online, you're going to find it. It's a very humane, user-friendly advanced directive. It has sort of a spiritual feeling to it. It doesn't just include things like, don't put me in the ICU and check this little ugly little legalistic checkbox. It's a beautiful document. It says things like, I wish to be massaged with oil or as I'm dying, or I would like someone holding my hand, or I would like someone reading poetry. So it allows you to imagine your death in a much fuller, more humane, even sacred context, rather than reducing it to like a medical procedure and yourself to just a medical diagnosis. I found it. I just think it's beautiful. So I highly recommend it.
I was just looking at it. I wish.
Oh yeah, good for you.
It's easy to find, and you know, it's who you want to make your healthcare decisions, the kind of medical treatment you want, how comfortable you want to be, how you want people to treat you, what you want your loved ones to know. It's all in there in the Five Wishes document. So I mean, even if people don't want to fill out the forms, you do have advice for the people who just can't bring themselves to do that.
Yes, write a letter. That's almost as good, frankly, as a signed advance directive that looks so legal. The other is to really talk about it. Actually, talking about it is more important than having the documents, because if your family's in conflict and you're in a medical crisis and you're in the ICU, there's often one family member that they call the nephew from Peoria. It's usually someone who flies in from far away who hasn't been very involved. And that person starts saying, I want you to do everything for mom. Don't let her die. And as long as that conflict exists in the family, the medical system is likely to continue to treat until the family comes into coherence and gets clear and says no. So talk about it. Maybe every New Year's Day, write a letter to your kids saying what you're doing with your estate plan, how you're feeling with your health, where you stand on how much you're enjoying your life, what is important to you to keep doing, and if you can't do it anymore, when do you feel it's time to bail?
Katie, you're bearing success already. Just about the time you said nephew in Peoria, I was thinking of my niece in Denver, but so there we go. Somebody closer. We move into a chapter called Slowing Down that you outlined earlier, and I wonder if people often resist recognizing this phase.
I think we do. That's one of the reasons I don't dye my hair anymore. I want to look in the mirror and be proud of the fact that I just turned 70 instead of ashamed. And slowing down, we notice that we recover from, you know, a minor sprain, say, more slowly than we used to. We need more sleep. We need naps. I'm a big fan of acceptance rather than denial, and that acceptance starts long before we actually end up on the deathbed.
There are stories you relate here about people who you know, loved ones may have discovered suddenly, like, oh boy, here's a medicine cabinet full of medications from multiple doctors. How do you recommend weeding out that overlap?
Yeah, there's two things I recommend. One is, if you can get into a coherent medical system, do it, like an HMO, a really good HMO like Kaiser or a Medicare Advantage plan. Some of these are great, some of them aren't. You have to do your research. The other is, put all these pills in one bag, like a big shopping bag, and ask for a medication review. Set up an appointment with your doctor, or you can do this often with a pharmacist. and it's for a medication review and that only. This is going to take at least that 15 minutes that they give you, if not a full half an hour. And then you go through pill by pill. You find out about the side effects and you say, could this medication be creating a side effect that's bothering me? Maybe my symptom is a side effect and not an actual original illness. Are any of these medications canceling each other out? Are any of these medications amplifying each other, perhaps to even a dangerous degree? And are some of these problems so minor that maybe it would be better off if I had no medication and we just saw how I did with none?
All right, so a lot of things to think about talk about with your doctor and have one doctor look at it all.
Exactly, and if you're on more than five meds, you're probably on too many.
The book is called The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. Katie Butler is the author of this book. It's a follow-up to her bestseller, Knocking on Heaven's Door, about the medicalization of death in our country. We're talking about moving away from that and making your own wishes known. You can join the conversation on The Exchange by phone and email. We'll be back with Katie Butler and The Art of Dying Well in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about the final days of life and how to plan well in advance of those days, how we would like those days to unfold. It does require thinking about your own death and identifying what you would think of as a good death for you. These are all recommended by Katie Butler in a book called The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. She walks us through from when our healing systems still work pretty well to when they really don't. You can join the conversation on The Exchange as we talk about ways to approach the end of life and what we think about that. Share some stories if you have them as well. 800-838-3760 to get in by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. Katie, we were talking about some very specific advice a few moments ago about, you know, the making sure that all your medications are in one bag, take that to the doctor, get a medication review. But beyond body needs, there's also some more general stuff in here. The thoughts you have here on simplifying life, what kinds of things fall into that category?
Well, lots of things do. Decluttering, letting go of a big set of china, say, that you no longer have the room to hold such a big party anymore and you don't have the energy to hold it. I think get rid of all the extraneous so you can really focus on the things that deeply matter to you.
And you also have some advice on dealing with loss because, of course, the older people get, the more their friends are going to be dropping around them.
Exactly. And I caution us against labeling this and pathologizing this as depression. It can be a very normal response to loss. I have a beautiful story in the book about my friend Doug von Koss. After his wife died, he created a little altar to her and just had things of hers, like her earrings, and every morning he would lift up this lace cover that he had placed over these little beautiful characteristic things of hers. And he would just cry and talk to her, mostly aloud. And then he would put the cover back over, the piece of lace, back over the little altar, and then he would go on and have his day. And he kept this up for some weeks or months. And then eventually he said, he read his marriage vows again, where it says, "Till death do us part." And he went, "Wow, death has parted us. I have fulfilled my vows, and now I can move on and create a new life for myself as a widower, a new stage of life for himself." He's living a beautiful widowerhood. He ended up repainting every room in the house, all of it in colors that he knew his dead wife would actually not have approved of. It was actually part of reclaiming and reconstituting a life so it could fit his new stage of life. And this is what rites of passage do for us. They help us transition from one social role to another. So the grieving widower becomes a single man and starts to date again, which Doug is now doing. They help us make these transitions in identity in a communal way. And that helps us sort of shed our old identities and move on. Of course, there's no such thing as closure, but they help us reconstitute our lives, which we need to repeatedly do.
And so, you know, it's not that you welcome these changes, but you deal with these changes. You find a way to make them constructive for you.
Exactly. And like a lot in life, the things we accept, we cope with a lot better than the things we just continue to fight.
Ah, okay. Which is a great rationale for the whole book, I guess, when you think about it.
Yeah.
Let us take a call here. We have Danae in Talent on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Katie Butler, the author of The Art of Dying Well. Hi, Danae.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
Good morning. I had a question. I was just looking at the Five Wishes legal document online and the states that actually validate that as a legal document, and Oregon, for some reason, is not on the list.
Hmm.
Huh. So I was just wondering if there's a way to petition that or if there's some way of getting that noticed as a legal document and how to go forward with that.
What, you know what I would do? I would get the Five Wishes document. I would fill it out because it's so reassuring and easy to do.
Yes.
Then I would get your official Oregon documents, and I would transfer that information over. Hmm. And then I would add the Five Wishes as an amendment at the back of your official document. The reason for this is Oregon is actually a nationwide leader in very, very good, very well-coordinated end-of-life documents. There's especially a whole series called the Pulse document, which is a physician's order for life-sustaining treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Oregon is you're way ahead of the rest of us. All of your EMTs know about these documents, and so that's why it's important to fill out the official ones. But you're going to want your family to have copies of the Five Wishes, too, because all of those things like massage me with oil or don't let my great aunt come see me because she just disturbs me, you know, whatever it is.
Sure.
It's more than a legal, it's more than a medical and legal question that you're preparing for. What a great question.
All right. Thanks, Danae. Appreciate the call. Take it
easy. Of course. Thank you so much.
We can take other calls at 800-838-3760 over the phone, or you can send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. We mentioned that the book goes in stages of life, and things really turn in Chapter 3, Adaptation. I mean, you know you won't get better. And is there often an incident that triggers this knowledge, you know, a fall or you know, something with the car or any of those things?
Yes. Often it's having to stop driving. I have a story in the book of a wonderful woman named Brawny, and she's promised her kids she won't drive at night, and then she comes home late, right around daylight savings time, and hits something and doesn't know what she's hit and goes home very, very shaken, crawling through the dark. Her eyes are failing. And her kids say, you got to stop driving. And as you probably know, if you're in a rural area or a suburban area, this can be a major, major life change. I strongly recommend a movement called the Villages Movement. This is a neighborhood-by-neighborhood movement of people who are trying to age in place, and so it gives you access to a network of volunteers who will drive you places. There's also an app called GoGo Grandmother. It's a service you can call. It's like an interface with Uber for older people who have flip phones or can't for one reason or another use a phone, a smartphone. So it acts as an interface, and it calls Uber for you. It makes all the arrangements. You have to adapt. You have to become interdependent with people. It's very good to be gracious and thankful to the people who do help you out. And this is where the emotional resilience comes in. You have to come to terms with limits about not being able to do as much or as quite exactly what you used to be able to do. And you also have to get really gracious about accepting help.
You know, I notice these contours of life a little better as I get older myself, but the fact that all the things that you wanted so badly before you were 18, you start to shuck off again, and in some cases,
exactly.
Voluntarily so, later in life.
Yeah. Well, I feel like the first two-thirds of life, we're building lives, we're building relationships, we're building identities, we're striving, we're struggling. And then the last third of life, we're thinking about the meaning of all that struggle. And we're thinking about ways to pass on our legacies. We may think about mentoring people, think about writing about, people write memoirs, people visit old neighborhoods and restore old friendships. people often return to earlier religious traditions that they had sort of set aside. There's people actually in this last third of life tend to be a lot happier than people who are younger. I mean, partly I think we just let go of those ambitions that we know we're never going to get to now. So this kind of driving discontent underneath things often falls away. So people in this last third are often happier and more content, despite health problems, than people who are younger. So it's a time to really savor and have meaning and practice generosity. There's a lot of fantastic fruits to this period.
We've talked so much, Katie, about medical considerations and you know how to know when this gets done and how to communicate this to your doctor and your loved ones. But there's an earlier thing to think about, which is how to decide when you can no longer live at home or live alone.
Yeah.
Do you have any ideas for a checklist or other aid in helping people decide?
Well, I do. You know, I do have checklists in the book, but I also want to point out what Atul Gawande, who wrote a very huge bestseller called Being Mortal, says.
Excellent medical writer, yeah.
Right. Fabulous. He says, we want autonomy for ourselves and we want safety for those we love. So I think I'm personally a big fan of staying in place and living at home as long as you possibly can. There's going to come a point where you're falling frequently, for example, and you can't rebuild your muscle strength, that you're going to have to go somewhere else. But I have checklists for what to consider when you move into some form of assisted living. I just think often it's the kids who prematurely stampede an older person into assisted living. And I think it's very important, if you're going to make a shift like that, that you be able to test drive the place you go to. Like, go stay for a week and see what it's really like to live there. And don't sort of, some people do it in a panic because of some crisis, and it rarely works out well.
You mentioned the findings of Valerie Hazanov, psychologist, and he did some studies about who did best in nursing homes. What did he find?
He found that you need to develop things you love and passions long before you end up in that place. If you have things you care about, it could be a baseball team, you know, it could be your grandkids, it could be watercolors. But if you haven't developed something you really love to do with your time before you end up in a nursing home, you're unlikely to discover it at a point where you're in, you know, chronic pain and all you talk about is your chronic pain. Another thing he found was that creatures of habit do a lot better. So having a daily schedule that you keep pretty religiously, which I do, frankly, that helps a lot, too. You create these routines, and even when you're in more difficult circumstances, you get up at the same time. You get dressed. You trundle down the wall on your walker. You have tea with your friend. You go work out in the gym. All of these things, this creation of structure, again, when you're younger, it's a good idea. But when you're older, it can really be a lifesaver and help you maintain a really high quality of life.
You've talked to lots of people, clearly, for this and
yes,
your previous
hundreds.
Book. Yeah, hundreds of them. Okay, so even if they've done all the prep work, I can imagine there's still a fair amount of difficulty in just moving into these next phases.
Yes, and especially because we have very broken healthcare systems and government systems to support us through this time period. So I very much recommend that people have a great degree of self-forgiveness when things don't work out as planned. However much anyone loves you, they may not be able to prevent you from having to go into a nursing home at some point. And even if you want to die at home, it may or may not happen. So in the book I say, we're not looking for perfection here, that perfection is a goal of medicine, it's a goal of science, it's a goal of technology, but dying is a very relational process, and the goals of an art are making the best use of the materials at hand, which tend to be limited, and really creating something beautiful about the scraps that we have to work with.
That's an interesting thought, the scraps we have to work. Well, okay, here's an example, and we have about a minute and a half left to get in the story about Norma Jean Bauer-Schmidt, stage 4 uterine cancer, and what did she decide to do? This is in a whole section called Go on an Adventure.
Yes. Well, She opted not to go into a nursing home, not to get treatment for her cancer. Instead, she got into an RV with her son and her daughter-in-law, and they spent a year going to national parks around the country. She'd hardly ever been out of Michigan, where she lived. And she just had a hell of a time. She rode in a hot air balloon. She had her nails done. She rode a horse. And then, at the end of the year, her son parked the RV in Friday Harbor, Washington. And she went on hospice and died a peaceful death there. She had a much better time than she would have if she had turned herself into an obedient patient and gone through every part of the litany of treatments that are offered us.
And as you point out, medicine rewards cure far better than care. If the cure is not possible, think about the care.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow, there's a lot to think about in this book, not nearly enough time to talk about it all, but we really appreciate the visit. Katie Butler, the author of The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. Thank you for visiting with us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much, Jeff. It was my pleasure.
All right, good to have you.
Take care.
Reminder, too, that she will be at Powell's Books in Portland, if you happen to be up that way, Sunday evening at 7:30.